Okay. So, what you're let me just ask to make sure. You're primarily focusing on the breath, but if other things come up, you are labeling that, and then you're coming back to the breath. Now, when you label the other things that come up, do you attempt to focus on that other thing intently, if only for a moment, and then come back? Or do you use the label to sort of say, oh, that's just CN, now I'm going to come back to the breath? So you use the labeling to sort of tell you, oh, I got distracted, let go of that, come back to this. It's the it's the second one, not the first one. As I said, two different ways, right? One is you actually focus on the thing you've labeled. The other, you're using the label to remind you, oh, that's just a thought, now come back to this. That's just a sound, now come back to the breath. You're doing it the second one. So as you now know very clearly, I like to be very, very precise about what we do. So what you're doing is a very common practice. You're noting, what you're really noting, what you're really focusing on is the rising and falling of your abdomen. You're using the mental labels to sort of dismiss distractions and come back to your abdomen. Now, when you are aware of the rising and falling of your abdomen, do you also mentally label rising, falling, or breathing?
No, I really like silence inside.
Okay. So you're primarily focusing on the sensation of breathing in a certain area, and you're using the labels to sort of acknowledge a distraction. You're coming back to the breath, but you're treating them as distractions. You're not really focusing on them as you label them.
Unless they really disturb me, like pain, so I focus.
Okay. Yeah, in that case, you're focusing on it. So what you're doing is something that is very commonly done. I call it dismissive labeling. And so my general philosophy about mindfulness is to do whatever works. Different techniques work for different people. Different approaches work for different people. So I encourage people to find what works for them. So if that works for you, fine. However, it is important to realize that the only thing that you're actually noting in this case is your breath. You're using the labels to remind you to let go of distraction. So you're not actually noting see in, hear in. You're just sort of labeling it. What you're focusing on is the breath. So that's perfectly okay. However, the more traditional Mahasi way of working is you're not just dismissing those. If you label it, you intently focus on it. And then if nothing else is coming up, then they have you come back to the breath. Now that's similar, but significantly different. In one case, you're just using labels to remind you to let go of distractions. In the other case, you're using those labels to name and then really note and intently focus on the thing that you're noting. So it's okay to do it any way you want, but it is, I think, important to realize that there's a difference between those two ways of working. I I usually, so that would be your own personal technique, so to speak. So one way, so if that works for you, that's fine. But in terms of if you're using my system, something out of my particular system, in my system, whatever you label, you try to intently experience that thing for a moment, and then you label something else. And I don't necessarily have people come back to the breath. I mean, you can do that. There are ways of doing that. But I don't make the breath the centerpiece of the practice for various reasons. Not that there's anything wrong with that. So if you're noting in the sense that I would use the word noting, then I call it you're using the labels to help you penetrate that experience. So when you note here out for an external sound, for just a moment you focus all your attention on that sound as though you were like shooting an arrow through that sound of like awareness, thrusting the awareness into it. And then if you label like see in, you do the same thing with that mental image. Well, it would be the same. In my system, okay, anything that you label, you're also intentionally focusing on it. So within the basic mindfulness system, you don't have dismissing labels, okay? The things you label, you try to completely experience. So it just depends what system or framework you want to work in. So can a person become completely enlightened by just focusing on the breath in their abdomen or the breath in the tip of the nose? Absolutely. But in order to do that, you have to make sure that that breath focus is really mindfulness, not just concentration. You want to bring clarity and equanimity into it. You want to specifically, you want to have a lot of detail, a lot of information about every tiny change in the sensation as your abdomen goes up and down, so that at some point your experience of the breath, the physical sensation of breath, the feel out in my language, the feel out of the breath, is so detailed and so continuous that it vanishes into just energy and emptiness. So your awareness has literally dissolved the physical sensation. That becomes then an insight experience, not just a concentration. So one of the problems with a lot of the way people do mindfulness is they just focus on the breath and they just build concentration, but it doesn't lead to insight into emptiness, no self, and impermanence. But it can. It all depends on the emphasis. If your emphasis is, okay, I'm just trying to get concentrated and grounded, then that's what will happen. You'll get concentrated and grounded, which is good. That's a lot better than being scattered and ungrounded. But if you work with the breath in a way so that you try to distinguish the in from the out, and then you can distinguish the beginning, middle, and end of the in, beginning, middle, and end of the out, and then you can distinguish in the beginning of the in-breath, there's little changes that take place. And in the middle of the in-breath, little changes. And the little end of the in-breath, little changes. At some point, you become so aware of the little changes that the breath becomes nothing but rising, passing, rising, passing. On one in-breath, you might have 24 little moments of rising, passing, rising, passing, rising, passing, rising, passing. And same on the out-breath. And then there's just passing, 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 gone, 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 gone. And then now you're starting to get insight into emptiness and impermanence. because of the, you brought the clarity in addition to the concentration. So there's absolutely, you don't have to do anything complicated like my system, which is very complicated. You can just choose one part of your body and just work with that. But you have to have the intention that there be clarity in addition to merely concentration. So that's a long answer to your question. Is that a sufficient answer?
So it's much more difficult to be, I'm just focused. I try to be very much specific, but it's more like a focus.
I understand. I'm just saying, if you have the intention to be specific, then you will be specific with time, and your breath meditation will turn into an insight practice.
It's more of a general question, maybe philosophical, that's been bothering me. If I understand correctly, the point of mindfulness is basically to break apart the sensory experience to basic elements, see the elements for what they are and their connection, and from that gain insight.
I would say that's a pretty good general
So my question is, how come it's really that hard? I mean, how come most people need to practice for many decades, sit in the temple somewhere for years, for something that it's supposed to be very intuitive, very basic, and very close to a person? Something doesn't really add up. I mean, is this a breaking habits that we accumulated over a long time, or are we born with this broken TV set? Something doesn't make sense. It's supposed to be very basic and very intuitive. Why does it take so long?
If it's natural, why does it take so long? Mm-hmm. This is a very reasonable question, and a question that actually we do get asked fairly, I get asked anyway, fairly frequently. So what I would say is, first of all, for some people, it actually doesn't take very long. There are some people that don't even meditate. They've never meditated, and enlightenment just happens to them. Okay? So we also have to think in terms of a bell curve. So on an average, okay, it takes a certain amount of time. But there are cases where people have never meditated, and just one day spontaneously, they are in the no-self. So that to me indicates that in fact it is natural. But as you say, for most people, it does take, quote, a lot of time. But then again, we have the issue of what is a lot of time, okay, relative to what. For example, for most people, to master a sports skill or something like that, it takes a lot of time, okay? Maybe 5-10 years of practice to get any good at something. So maybe 5-10 years to develop mindfulness skills, it's not a lot of time. Because people allocate that much time to other kinds of skills. Also, I would say that we also have to think of the big picture. At this particular point in human history, if people want to develop these kinds of skills, they have to allocate a certain amount of time to it. But I suspect that for most of human history, which is prehistory, most of the time that we've been humans is not the way we've been in the last 5,000 years, okay? We've been humans for tens of thousands, probably maybe even a few million years. Humans have existed. Now, more tribal peoples who have simple lifestyle and who have uncomfortable life, they, I think, are more in a mindful state in general, just naturally. If you look at like tribal people from the Amazon who have had no contact or with modern culture, they sort of look like Buddhist masters, their eyes, whatever. And I'm not saying that they really have mindfulness skills, but I'm saying that they can get concentrated relatively easily. I have spent quite a bit of time with Native Americans participating in their ceremonies. And I can tell you that they have no special training, but if they beat a drum for a couple hours, they're absolutely in samadhi. An Eskimo, the way Eskimos hunt seals in the winter, they cut a hole in the ice and they squat with a spear and they wait for the seal to come through the hole. That seal will come through the hole sometime in the next 2 or 3 days.
Mm.
And that seal will only be up for 5 seconds and then will disappear. And that Eskimo will sit there with that spear without any wandering of attention, squat for 2 days to kill that seal. Well, that's a natural concentration. That skill is just there. The Plains Indians of the United States, their largest, most important ceremony is something called the Sun Dance. There's no special training for this. Ordinary people do it, men, women, and children. This involves 4 days without food or liquid, dancing in 110 degrees Fahrenheit with pierces through your body. Now, if you talk to a doctor and you say, under these circumstances, how long will it take for a person to die? Well, because I've asked this question, okay? Well, they say, oh, they're dead in 2 days. Except I, with my very own eyes, many times have seen people do this for 4 days. And they get cut. You have to lay down, and they take a knife, and they cut your skin, and they insert
a hook.
Yeah, not a hook. They didn't use hooks. It sort of looks like a short pencil that's been carved, that's inserted. Okay. No one screams, no one flinches. Everybody is completely relaxed while this is going on, and you could have 100 dancers, and every one of them is exactly the same. They just go into complete equanimity. Sometimes they are then. Those skewers are attached to a rope, and they actually pull them up by their own skin, and they hang like that as a prayer. That's their form of prayer. And their bodies are completely relaxed, everyone, and they have no training. No, they're not yogis. They're not meditators. They just go into equanimity. So I think for most of our history, prehistory, people tended to go into states of concentration and equanimity fairly readily. I'm not saying they were enlightened or whatever, but I'm saying that these skills were more readily available to our ancestors. And I think that they will also be more readily available to our descendants. We just are in an awkward zone in human history between the primitive oneness and the more scientific oneness. So I think in the big picture, averaged over the big picture of humanity, the millions of years, our present situation, where it seems to take a long time, may not really be representative. So that's sort of the way I think about it. Yes. Well, I would say that the note, that the labeling and the noting helps you be clear, concentrated, and equanimous with what comes up. So you can detect it, you can focus on it, and you can open up to it. Yes, that's the goal.
So, I kind of have a problem with sometimes I'm acknowledging. Debating myself, what is it, what category for it. If you could say something.
Can you, yes, can you give me specifics of, okay, I'm not quite sure what to call this, I'm not quite sure what to call that.
Okay. I did your retreat 2 years ago, and I understand some of the terms have changed.
I probably did change, yes.
Yeah. And I was practicing for a while, and it was touch, feel.
Oh, yeah,
talk.
I did change that. That's right. Sorry. It happens.
And I did that for a while, and then things started moving. It wasn't exactly or disappearing, or so I kind of stopped. I gave up on trying to find out what it was and just stay with it.
Well, that's fine. But let me ask you: are you saying that by moving you mean like literally, like flowing, like energy?
Yeah.
Okay. When that happens, where your clarity is in the awareness that it's flowing. Yes, this is important. So, we start by making distinctions. So we can distinguish, even a child can distinguish visual from auditory from somatic. Even a three-year-old knows see, hear, feel. Okay? So that's a very clear distinction, visual, auditory, somatic. Now we say, okay, can we make further distinction? Can we distinguish physical seeing from mental image? Well, yeah, we can. So we can distinguish see in versus see out. Can we distinguish physical sound from mental talk? Okay. Well, yeah, actually we can do that. Can we be aware when we're having emotional sensations in the body? When we're having an emotion, can we ask ourselves, does the emotion affect my body? And answer either yes or no. So we can detect when the body becomes involved in an emotional experience. So we could call that feel in, okay? Then we could call all the other stuff feel out, just because that's what we're going to call it. We can also distinguish certain states that are restful. Some of them involve an absence of activity, but some of them just are restful qualities, like relaxation. Relaxation is an actual sensation. It's not an absence, but it's restful. When we look at the dark or the bright, okay, that's actually a sensory experience, but it's visual and it's restful. So we can distinguish restful states. So we can make these distinctions. And those can be useful. But then, any of those categories, the see, hear, feel, the inner activations, the outer activations, the restful states, any of those categories can either be stable, so they don't change, they don't like shift around or vibrate or anything, they're just stable, but it is also possible they won't be stable, that they'll be changing. Now, if they're changing, if the changingness becomes really strong, it will start to destroy all the other distinctions. That's not bad. In fact, that's really good. So the first thing that will happen is, if you get a lot of flow, a lot of change in the see in, the see out and the see in, then the see out and see in will become one wave, and you won't be able to distinguish them anymore. If there's a lot of flow and change and energy in the here out and the here in, they'll merge, and you won't be able to distinguish here in, here out anymore. You won't be able to, your body will just turn into a field of energy, and you won't be able to distinguish feel in from feel out, or from feel rest. Okay? So the inner activation, the outer activation, and the restful states will start to merge together because there's just they're just one wave, one wave. So what the flow does is it destroys distinctions. So the fact that when things started to flow, you couldn't make distinctions anymore, that's what you reported, correct? That's not a sign you were doing anything wrong. That's what's supposed to happen. So then what can you distinguish? You can distinguish whether the flow is visual, auditory, or somatic. You can note see flow, hear flow, feel flow. However, if the change and flow becomes really powerful, you can't even distinguish see from hear from feel. That's not bad. That's good. That's really good. The label for that is just flow. And when that happens, you're getting integration. Yechida. Okay? Everything is becoming one and unified as a field of energy. So, mindfulness is about making distinctions, but it's also about destroying distinctions. Making healthy distinctions, making distinctions in a healthy way, and then destroying distinctions in a healthy way. The ultimate destroyer of distinctions is gone. There's only one zero. There's only one number that isn't a number, in a sense. So, flow, the impermanence theme, flow and gone, those actually destroy the distinctions we so carefully make with the other techniques. And by alternating the techniques that make distinctions with the techniques that destroy distinctions, we go to deeper and deeper levels of oneness. Okay? So what you're reporting, if I properly understand, is actually not a problem at all, but exactly what we would expect to happen. So in that case, all you need to distinguish is see flow, hear flow, feel flow. But if you can't even distinguish that, then just be aware there's nothing but flow. Just flow is the label for that. So does that make sense? Does that agree with your experience? Okay, good. Then that's what I have to say about that. Not a problem. Definitely not a problem. Yes?
It's a general question. What you said before, can you develop a little bit the path to no self? You said concentration, the mindfulness, equanimity.
Clarity. I use the word sensory
clarity.
Okay,
the whole chain and where the metta meditation and is metta meditation.
And where does that enter in? Did you want me to describe it with regards to the breath, or just
no,
in general?
No, you told them about how to arrive to know self.
Through the breath.
Generally.
I specifically was talking about the breath. There are essentially, you can take any sensory experience, and if you bring enough mindfulness to it, it will be an enlightenment experience. So it can be...
What in between?
Okay, so what are the stages in between? Oh, you want me to again describe what I described to her? Okay, yes, let's go over it again. I can give you many examples. It's like math. You have to see many examples of a general theorem, and then it's like, oh, I see. I sort of get the big picture here. So let me describe to you how to become enlightened with your breath, and then I'll describe to you how to become enlightened by walking, and then I'll describe to you how to become enlightened by observing your thoughts and emotions. Does that sound like a good deal?
Good deal.
Very good one.
Okay. And then the idea is to eventually see that this is, that what I'm describing is all the same thing. So let's start. Yes.
Can we get enlightened with what we did in the past 3 days? Only the
yes.
restful state?
Actually, the classic... the
classic by resting.
You can definitely do that. There's a path of pleasure. There's a path of pain. You know, whatever path you take. The classic descriptions of... okay, so I think you know that the mindfulness practice in Asia is called vipassana. And vipassana is associated with Southeast Asia, historically. That means Thailand, Burma, Sri Lanka. I mean, it came from India, but it's been preserved in Southeast Asia. So in Southeast Asia, the scriptures that they use are in a language called what?
Pali.
Very good. Pali is a kind of simplified Sanskrit. So if you look at, and we say in English, the Pali canon. Canon means like Bible, okay? It's interesting that Hebrew Bible is Tanakh, right? There are three divisions. So actually the Pali canon also has three divisions. Mm-hmm. And it's called the Tipitaka. T means three, Pitaka means baskets. So the first basket is called the Sutta Pitaka. And that contains the historical sermons that the Buddha himself delivered. So the second sermon, the second sutta in the Pali canon is called Samanyapala Sutta. And pala means fruit or reward, payoff. Samanya means the life of a meditator. So it's the sermon on the payoff that you'll get if you live the life of a meditator. The Buddha says, okay, here's what you'll get. And it's very interesting to see. He was a motivational speaker. You know what we call motivational speaker?
The convention.
Huh?
You can invite him to any convention.
Yeah, and he would motivate people. So what he does is he lists maybe a couple dozen benefits, starting with the most superficial and ending with the most profound. So we can sort of see his value system by reading that scripture. Once again, it's called the Samanyapala Sutta. I'm translating it as maybe the benefits of the meditative life. Someone else might translate it differently, the title. So he says, if nothing else, if you practice meditation your whole life, if nothing else, people will respect you. So that's like total ego, right? It's like, I'm cool, I meditate, I didn't get anywhere, but at least I did it. So, but the Buddha said, well, if nothing else, that's a payoff, okay? That's the most superficial payoff. But then he talks about more deeper. And when he gets into the descriptions of meditation, he essentially gives a description of tranquility practice, going deeper and deeper into states of bliss and tranquility. And my restful states are a reworking of that, okay? But then, that doesn't end there, okay? That's about halfway through. Then he talks about that you see the impermanence, okay? It just breaks up into energy, and you see the vanishing, the impermanence of those restful states. And that then takes you to a kind of absolute rest that he called nirvana, which is the goneness, okay? So essentially, the classic path, as it appears at least in this rather early Buddhist literature, is a description of going into states of bliss, tranquility, and concentration, and then seeing the emptiness and impermanence of that bliss, and going to a bliss that's beyond pleasure and pain. So, absolutely, you could get enlightened with the restful states. So maybe, shall I add that to the list and give you four ways to, four descriptions of exactly the same thing? Well, you have to pay extra. Okay, let's start with walking. Let's say that you want to become liberated just by paying attention to walking. So, you start by being aware, right, left, right, left, like that. And let's make things simple. Let's just, to oversimplify it, say that it takes 1 second to take one step, okay? So this means that every second you have a clear awareness, right, left, right, left. Now, can we have greater clarity? Well, yeah. We could be aware when you lift your foot on the right, when you swing it, when you place it. Lift, swing, place. So now, every second, how many clear awarenesses are there per second?
Three.
Now, let's say that you can not just only be aware of the beginning, middle, and end, but you can be aware of the beginning of the beginning,
the middle of the
middle, of the middle, the end of the end, okay?
Heel up, lifting, moving, lowering.
Yeah, that's right. You get finer discrimination, okay? So now, once again, we're going to simplify the math. It won't be exactly this. But let's say that now you're aware of nine things per second. So that's a lot more information, right? So we start two things per second, now three things, now nine. Now let's say that each of those subdivisions, you're aware of that there's an arising, a brief existence, and then a passing, okay? Rising, passing, rising, passing. So now maybe you're aware of maybe 27 things per second, okay? So your experience of walking is becoming sensorially richer and richer and richer. There's more and more data there. So from that perspective, the experience of walking is becoming more and more real to you. But now, let's look at it from another point of view. If I'm aware, right, left, right, left, what is the longest that I can hold on to anything? If every second I have to be aware right now, in the next second I have to be aware left. How, what's the longest I can hold on to right? 1 second. Now let's say that I'm aware of three things. What's the longest I can hold on to any of those? 1/3. Let's say that I'm aware of 9 things, okay? 1/9. Now there comes a time when So the human nervous system can only process a finite amount of data in a given length of time, okay? It's a finite system. If you have somewhere between 27 and 81 clear awarenesses per second, that saturates the information channel. That's as much information as can consciously flow. And this is all information just about walking, okay? So somewhere, I'm guessing, between 27 and 81 bits of information, that's as rich as that experience can become. However, at that point, you have to let go so fast that the experience never has a chance to turn into a thing. It never coagulates into a something. So at the point where the awareness is maximally rich, you're actually aware of nothing. It is paradoxical. You can't put it into words. It's so present that it's absent. So now, if the only thing that you can be aware of at that point is space vibrating. And space vibrates, and then space disappears. Vibrates, disappears. And that's all you're aware of. There's no feet walking anymore. There's just this vibrating space, and that vibrating space reaches out and grabs your whole body and your from your feet. It reaches out and it grabs your whole body and it grabs your mind and it grabs the sights and sounds around you and it pulls everything into a dimensionless point wherein there is no time, there is no space. There is no inside, there is no outside, there is no self. And then, an instant later, that shalom bim romav, that divine absolute rest, breaks apart. And the self and world reappear from it. But you realize that that's what you're born from. And that's enlightenment through walking. Through having a complete experience of walking. Now, the same is with the breath. You're aware rising, passing, 2 things per second. Okay? Then you're aware of the smaller divisions, then the smaller divisions. It's exactly the same deal. Okay? Then at some point, the breath dissolves into just rising, passing, then just passing. Then everything is pulled into that black hole. Not just your body, not just your mind, everything. All past, all future. And then it breaks apart. Time and space, self and world reappear. But you see where you come from. And your concept of what time, space, self and world are is never the same again. It's the same with the restful states. See rest, hear rest, feel rest. But then there's flow inside. Okay, that blank screen is sort of like vibrating and pixelating, and you hear these vibrations in the quiet. Okay, yeah. and the relaxation is just sort of caressing you and circulating around, and then at some point there's just flow. You can't distinguish anything anymore. There's just flow, And then there's just flow and go. Just vibration gone, vibration gone, vibration gone. But that's is a bigger one, right? If we're working with the feet, we're working with some small piece of experience, penetrating that, and then that grabs everything else. But the restful states are large because they involve visual, auditory, and somatic. So that's like a big piece of experience, and you're working with that, but the path, the steps you go through is identical. And then let's say that you do the focus in technique. So where does my self come from? See in, hear in, feel in. That's thoughts and emotions. You're observing your thoughts and emotions. It's complicated. But at some point, the images are all vibrating, disappearing, vibrating, disappearing. The mental talk rises, passes away, rises, passes away. Same with the emotional sensations. And the see in, hear in, feel in, they just turn into flow. And when you look inside, you're just this, you don't have thoughts and emotions anymore. For a moment, you just have this energy, and then the physical world follows. And same thing happens. It's all the same, okay? You escape into completeness. So, in the Jewish tradition, it's very interesting. I mean, there was this rabbi in Los Angeles that he's like a Chabadnik rabbi that I knew. And so I asked him, well, what's the essence of orthodoxy as you understand it, you know? And so they study these, they study Kabbalah, they study Tanya, which is a, you know, an Aramaic thing. They study Ha'ari, you know, Isaac Luria. So he said, well, if I had to summarize it, there's two goals. The first goal is Bitul Hayesh, to experience the annihilation of the somethingness of self and world. And the second goal, once you have Bitul Hayesh, then you can experience Bri'ah Yesh Me'ayim. How, and this is in real time. This is not Bri'ah 5,000 years ago, okay? It's second by second how the self and the world come out of Ayin, the divine nothingness. To actually experience that process, and that's what the Etz Chaim is about, the Sfirot, they show that process. So the goal is, that's why we sort of daven the way we do, so we're trying to like be like a flame that of a candle that gets blown out. That's what he said. Now that's exactly the meaning of nirvana, is to blow a candle flame out. Parallels with Buddhism are really quite extraordinary. Then after that, you see how, so you sort of go to the Ayin, which is also the Ein Sof, because it's unlimited in any way, big or small. And then from that time on, you can see how things arise. So I asked this rabbi, how many people in your movement actually experience that? And he said, not many, okay? Not very, very seldom. And I looked him straight in the eye, and I said, that's exactly what I teach people to do. And people do experience it. Not everyone, but a lot of people actually experience that. Looked him straight in the eye, and he knew I was telling the truth. It was quite an interesting moment. And it gave me a nice insight into my Jewish sholesh. So that's what it is. That's the way I look at it. And that's the way my teacher looks at it. Out where my manuals are, Doshin brought a book, a picture book of my teacher. That's this whole, you'll hear me talk about expansion, contraction, and zero and all that stuff. I didn't discover it myself. I learned it from this Japanese Zen master. you can take a look if you want and see where this came from. These specifically, so that's your grandfather teacher.
Is there a picture of you in the book?
Yes.
Many pictures.
Yes, yes, yes.
That book was issued at his 100th birthday. Choshin, were you there? You couldn't make it. Michal was there.
Leonard Cohen was there.
You know who? Yeah, you know. Leonard has come here and give concerts. Leonard Cohen.
Yeah.
Cohen. So I know Leonard very well because he's a student of Sasaki Roshi. I have sung backup for Leonard Cohen. Okay. Of course, it was Kanji Zaibosa. You know, it was like, you know, chanting in the Sutra Hall, right? But he's here. I'm here. We've sung together. I can play. And I have sung with Leonard Cohen many times, not just once. So Leonard has been, yeah, that's right. And Leonard was there that day. That's right. So that was Sasaki Roshi. Roshi means a Zen master. That was Sasaki Roshi's 100th birthday. On that day, he talked for 2 hours. Straight. He is now 105.
Oh, la, la.
Yeah. He never stops. He never takes vacations. He's just, there's nothing to do but teach. So, anyway, so did you get your money's worth? Is that enough?
And the metta in between.
Yes.
The
metta. Where does the metta fit? Here, okay, so metta means loving kindness. The way, once again, I have my own sort of way of thinking about these things. From my perspective, there are two important things. One is to see beyond the personal self. And the other is to refine and perfect the personal self. And I reckon spiritual maturity to be when you realize that these two endeavors reinforce each other, that there's a relationship. The more you refine and perfect the personal self, the easier it is to see beyond the self. The more you've seen beyond the self, the easier it is to refine and perfect. So there are practices. So what I just described to you is half of the path. It's the deconstruction. But then I think it's also important to have a reconstruction, where you reconstruct the self not as a thing, but as a doing, and we want that doing to be ethical and kind, and if I were to use the word, the Yiddish word, a mensch, mm-hmm. We want you to be a mensch in that sense of that word. So practices like loving kindness and the practice of sila, which is the practice of ethics, I sort of group those together. I consider those to be part of reconstructing the human. And so it's a dialectical process going back and forth, deconstruct, reconstruct, deconstruct, reconstruct. And the deconstruction gets deeper and deeper, and you become less and less and less of a person. But at the same time, your personality gets freer and freer and freer, and you become a better and better and better activity of self, as you become less and less and less of a thing called self. So I see, I generalize loving kindness, I broaden the definition to include not just loving kindness, but any practices that intentionally create and nurture positive emotion, or positive thinking, rational or, you know, appropriate thinking, or that are related to positive behavior change. And so I put sila, or ethics. Actually, I group that with things like metta, because to me, that's all part of the reconstruction of the human. So traditional Buddhism, you start with sila, then samadhi, then prajna. You first develop an ethical basis, then you develop some concentration, then you get wisdom, and that's sort of that's the standard formulation. But I chop it up differently. I have people go for the wisdom first, wisdom and concentration, but then parallel to that, do practices that I call nurture positive, that reconstruct the human so that you sort of are deconstructing and reconstructing as one endeavor, so to speak. That's the way I like to look at it. Furthermore, because I define mindfulness in terms of concentration, clarity, equanimity, from that broad definition, a practice like loving kindness is a mindfulness practice because it develops those skills. Your attention gets distracted from the loving kindness, you come back, okay? You have to allow those distractions to come and go without resisting them, even though you're not focusing on them. So that's equanimity. You have to have equanimity with the negative. It's going to come up. When you try to do positive, the negative is going to come up. If you say, that's okay, it can come up in the background, you're bringing equanimity to that negative. Moreover, because how do you know that you have a positive content to your thoughts and emotions? Well, you know because you have positive image, positive talk, positive emotional sensation. So you're becoming intimate with the subjective atoms. The same way by doing loving kindness and making it being clear what part of the loving kindness is image, what part is talk, what part is emotional body. Well, now you're cultivating clarity. That's clarity with regards to your sense of self. So from that broad definition, we can actually include loving kindness as part of the mindfulness. So everything's integrated. That's why you've got the five ways. So you can, you see beyond the self by teasing apart, see in, hear in, feel in. That's one form of becoming free from the self. But then another form of becoming free from the self is you anchor in other, in the sights and sounds and physicality. And that's sort of a Zen strategy. Okay? And then the restful states free you from the self too, because they're restful, but they're also thinned out. They're attenuated forms of sensory experience. So that's also deconstructive. And then the flow and the vanishing are absolutely deconstructive. So you focus in, focus out, focus on rest, focus on flow. What are you going to do next? Nurture positive. And then some people do a complete workout routine like that. They step through each one of those themes. And it's a deconstructive sequence. And then at the end, you reconstruct positive affect, which means emotion. You reinforce positive behaviors in your life. You reinforce appropriate cognitions in your mind. That's how you end. And then you can go through the cycle again. Deconstruct. Reconstruct, deconstruct, reconstruct.
Are we going to do that in the week?
We don't have enough time to cover all of that. And furthermore, Amutat Tovana, I asked them, what do you want me to teach? I sent them the manual. I said, you know your people. What do you want me, I'll teach what you want. So they said, well, we want you to do restful states and positive states. So that's what I'm doing. However, if you do the home practice program, the telephone-based thing, then you can just pick and choose. You can learn all of these things via telephone if you wish. However, the system is designed so that you can simply pick one technique and go all the way with that also. So you don't necessarily have to do this complicated thing. Now you might say, well, why did you develop the complicated thing? Well, because it's designed for personal coaching, actually. Even though I'm forced to teach it here in a group setting, it's actually designed to have your own teacher who interactively coaches you and finds what works optimally for you at a given time, and then keeps you doing that. And then as challenges and windows of opportunity come up, the thing loops and branches like an algorithm. It's like a computer program that can optimize your experience. But you have to have a personal coach take you through it. And I've trained, at this point, several hundred people have been trained to be facilitators, that they can work with you and be a personal coach. And so it's designed to be used that way, so it has to have flexibility. And then the next step is to create an automated version that is computer-based with artificial intelligence that replicates the facilitator. And then everyone in the world can have their own personal mindfulness coach available 24/7 for almost no cost at all. So to replicate my coaching skills into artificial intelligence software. And we actually have a working version of that program. It's not released to the public yet, but we're testing it at the University of Vermont Medical School for pain management. So the doctor simply says, okay, go to this website, register, and they get they get someone that talks to them. It's not like a keyboard, okay? It's actually, it asks them questions and they answer, and you get the impression that there's actually a person guiding you. And it gives the, ultimately, the goal is that it would give you exactly the same guidance that I would give you. Mm-hmm. Except there's only one, like, No, content-wise. Mm-hmm. Because we reproduce my decision process into software. Now, okay, I'm saying content-wise, but also it's my voice recording.
And your intuition, what about that?
Huh?
And your intuition?
My intuition can be largely reduced to logical deductions. And so it took intuition to figure out the logic of enlightenment. That took intuition. But once the logic is figured out, there's nothing intuitive a machine can implement. Don't think of it as a lesser version of a teacher. Think of it as a vastly improved version of a CD. If it can only replicate 70% or 50% of what I do, but it can do that for 10 million people for a dollar a month, 24/7, you call it in the middle of the night when you can't sleep, you call it when you're in pain, and it's always there. And you never have to think, oh, I don't want to call him and wake him up. Mm. So if 10 million people can use it, and it only does half of what I do, but it essentially, it's not just listening to a tape, okay? It knows who you are. It knows everything you've done in previous sessions. It calls you by name. It relates to you like a human being. And it knows the path to enlightenment. And you think of it, you can think of it as, imagine a library of 10 million guided meditations, each one of which is slightly different from the other, okay? And somebody is going to automatically pick the one out of 10 million that is optimal for you at a given instant. That's what this does. That's my goal. So one of the reasons I created that algorithm was to be able to automate the process of bringing people to enlightenment. Why? Because there are plenty of qualified teachers, but relative to the number of humans,
they're very few.
So how can we, in the modern age, make this available to the great masses of humanity? Well, this is a start. So, yeah, a lot of thought went into it. A lot of very, out-of-the-box thought. Sorry, I just started blabbering and got carried away. Anyway, that's why it is the way it is. It's designed...
So it's like guided meditations?
Well, it's the basis of guided meditations that a personal coach can give you or that an automated program can give you. But a personal coach, how much time can they give you, right? But an automated program, it can be there for you all day, every day, whenever you need it.
So until it happens, what do we do?
You do exactly what we're going to do for the next week.
Well, just what is this circle you said?
Circle?
The techniques? How do you go there? The circle of...
Cycle, sorry. Well, yeah, some people like to do the focus in, then the focus out. Okay, it's sort of a natural progression. You sort of like deal with your inner world. Then it's possible to sort of anchor in your outer world. So you have a no-self experience first by untangling your thoughts and emotions. Then you can have a no-self experience by merging with the outside world. Then you can have a no-self experience by there's just nothing but see, hear, feel, rest. Then inside all of the above, you tune into the flow and the vanishing. And that takes you really into a no-self experience. Where are you going to go from there? Well, then you do loving kindness, positive thoughts. You work on changing behaviors. That's the nurture positive. And then if you want, you can go through the cycle again. And each...
It's the same order like in the manual, I think.
Yes, yeah. You can do it that... some people do it that way. Some people learn the whole system. And then it's like... it's like a gym, like a exercise equipment. You exercise individually each muscle group. You exercise, like Nautilus, you exercise your arms, you exercise your legs. Then at the end, you get to go into a jacuzzi. That's the loving kindness.
With a lot of bubbles.
One session?
Yes.
About the practice of C. And sight. Every time I meditate, my eyes participate. If I hear from this direction, sometimes my eyes follow the direction that the sound comes from. Or if there is a sensation.
Body sensation, it's here, your eyes.
Yeah, then my eyes, and then I try to relax the eyes. And then it all of a sudden comes back again, this involuntary movement of the eye. While I do see rest, I can sense that there is no rest because I'm watching or observing with the eye.
Yeah, the eye, the muscles of the eye get involved.
Yes, are involved. And then I relax it. And the thing I discovered that there is, it's like the eye doesn't function. There is only sight. I don't have to do anything in order to see. I don't have to move any muscle. The same thing I can feel about hearing. That I don't have to do anything in order to hear or to focus on anything. It just happened by itself. And then I don't understand, what is it? What is it, this sight? What, when I see or when I close my eyes and the images or the particles or whatever the object for observation that is there is almost surrounding me. I don't understand what it is. I don't understand what is the nature of it.
The nature
and how it's related
to the
actual organ, the eye that's moved, and the eyelids that are not really closed. Even when they are closed, they are not really closed. There is more relaxation.
Yes. Relaxation. So you're sort of asking, what is the nature of consciousness, and how does it relate to the organs?
The organs that that observe it. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Exactly.
Okay.
Actually.
Well, I.
Thank you.
I do not know the answer to that. And I sincerely doubt that any human being knows at this point in history, although many people write books claiming to know that. But personally, I do not know. Well, the question is essentially, what's the nature of consciousness and what's the relationship between consciousness and our nervous system and the physical organs of perception? Is that more or less correct?
Yeah.
And so that's the question that's being asked. It's certainly a good question, but I have to be honest and say I don't have a clue. I do not know what consciousness is. I do not know the relationship between consciousness and the nervous system of human beings. I think it would be nice to know, but I don't think it's essential to know that, because I can tell you things about sensory experience that I have a lot of confidence in, but I have no idea what the senses actually are, how they relate to reality or the nervous system. These points are furiously debated by scientists and by philosophers. So let them debate, okay? They seem to think it's really important. It's, for me, not so important. Because the things I mean, if you really ask a physicist, what is gravity? If you ask an expert physicist, now, what really is gravity? They'll probably say, well, we don't really know. But we can write many books that tell you important and deep things about it, okay? Richard Feynman, who is a famous physicist in where I come from in Southern California, when I was a kid in the 50s, he once said, if you think you understand quantum physics, you do not understand quantum physics, okay? He was one of the greatest quantum physicists. And if you read his physics lectures, they're not an easy read, okay? But there's three-volume lectures of him actually speaking that they recorded and just printed it. Like he said, it's not a textbook. It was what he actually said at Caltech when he taught first-year physics. And what that book is full of, we don't know what this is, and I don't understand what this is, okay? It's just full of don't know. So I don't know what consciousness is, but I can tell you things that are true and very useful about it. And that's enough for me, okay? So one thing that you mentioned is actually significant, I think, but I want to ask. You said that there's this sense of all aroundness to your senses, right? Like it's all, like, is that true for see, hear, and feel? That sense of like on all sideness?
Feel and hear, yes. See, it's in deeper situation.
When you go deeper. So I would suggest to you that sense of being on all six sides at once, that's very significant, okay? I can't tell you what consciousness is, But I can tell you that if you experience it right, left, front, back, up, down, all at once, that's expansive flow. And that's half of flow. The other half is contractive flow. So if you yield to expansion, so that, to me, that report, you're reporting the expansive flavor of flow, yang, okay, or what the Kabbalim called chesed, you know, it's like affirmation, love, okay, it's just going out. So if you experience that all aroundness, surrender to all aroundness and just let it pull you apart.